a team of dogs and sled and a bunch of furs, and they hit a drift pile and dove under the drift pile. Everything went under. The dogs were chained to the boat, and I guess the boat and dogs stayed under there. And was it Charlie that came out on to the surface somewhere?
Al. And George was down.
He had a plate in his head. Uh-huh. His brother George was drowned. Uh-huh. And Al spent, I think, 11 days
trying to find him.
Mosquitoes eating him up and wandering cross country. Came to an old camp and he scrounged some cracker crumbs off the floor or something. And he took a little board doghouse and got in the river and floated down river with that, I think, wasn't it? Uh-huh. At one time he woke up in a swamp with just his nose out of the water, or his face, all underwater, muskeg.
Holy
smoke. And just covered with mosquitoes. They were terrible.
But he survived.
Tommy told me the story, and I wish I had it down word for word. It was really something to listen to. And some people coming up river in a boat came upon him. He was just talking sort of out of his head when they caught him in that little doghouse floating down river.
For heaven's sakes.
11 days after he wrecked.
Yeah, Margaret Murray talks about a couple of incidents where people have gone,
Oh, yes.
Under the ice.
That's right. Or if you got into these silt-filled rivers, you just didn't get out.
Yeah.
And if you're floating downstream and you get into those drift piles, you're very helpless. The water goes into them fast, goes through them.
Yeah, and then it sucks you under.
Carries you under often.
Mm-hmm. And we had some raft races here in the Chena River. It started out as a lark, grew into something tremendous. Mm-hmm. And I guess about 300 rafts, just homemade rafts. Mm-hmm. The rules were you had to have a minimum of 6 barrels for flotation. Mm-hmm. And some of the god-awfulest concoctions for superstructures. Mm-hmm. And the last one was 2 years ago, and there were 2 people drowned. It was high water. Mm-hmm. But it was tremendous fun. They were hilarious parties, and it was just one big good time between Fairbanks and Nenana. Mm-hmm. Too much drinking on some of them. They, ironically, the 2 who were drowned were from very sober groups. Just happened that they hit those drift piles and were sucked under and lost.
I and his friends floated. I made a little rough skiff out of the dunnage in the railroad yard, and we put a tarp under it, and we floated halfway to Nenana. And the river got so slow we thought we'd never get there, so we took the tarp off our skiff and left it there and hiked over to the railroad. Came out just the other side of, we came up the back side of Esther Dome. Mm-hmm. And over the dome and down to the railroad camp. And we were really, or the FE camp, we speared a meal there, but we'd been eating a few raisins and some sour cranberries for a couple of days there. That food tasted good.
Did you ever work for FE Company? Everybody else up here has.
No, I sold them timber and leggings. I did a lot of wood hauling to Fairbanks, and I sold them quite a lot of leggings and timbers, and the Rhodes Hall mine.
Do you remember when the Link family came to Fairbanks?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I talked to Jack Link. He was the King Regent this year, so I talked to him and ended up doing a story for the News Miner because they didn't have anybody on the staff.
That was good, too. That was good. Now, they came in in the 30s? Was it 28? Uh-huh.
He came in March, and then his family came up in,
and she
just
was
before
such
school.
A beautiful woman. Yeah.
Just before school started. Uh-huh.
Lots of interesting people drifted in because of the FE.
Both the King and Queen Regent this year happened to be FE connected. Mm-hmm. You know, Jack worked as office manager there for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Actually, he was with U.S. Smelting for 45 years, coming from Arizona.
Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that he was with U.S. Smelting first.
And then, yes, he joined him in 1913 in California, in Oatman, Arizona. Mm-hmm. And then he went to Colorado and then up here. And Lena Phipps' husband, she married Oscar
Phipps
in 1952.
Oscar Phipps. Yes, we knew Oscar.
So they hadn't been married for
very long.
Very long, actually. He died in 1968. Uh-huh. But he lived here, and he worked for FE.
I wouldn't be surprised.
35 years.
I wouldn't be surprised if U.S. Smelting came back up and went to work again, because a young fellow that's mining up on Caribou Creek wanted to buy some hydraulic pipe, and the company wouldn't sell any more hydraulic pipe. And they probably had some good ground yet. And who was that miner out at our house there?
I forgot.
He says he knew of $5 per square foot ground past Chattanooga somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Up or downstream, must be downstream. But it was deep, of course, and wet ground. It'd be difficult to mine, yeah. But that's at the old price, so they might devise some way to take it out.
Yeah, but that Chattanooga dredge is gone. It's done.
Yes.
Called Gapson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, they took that one out.
Did you know Roy Erling?
I just had met him. I didn't really know him. My husband knew him. He's a FE graduate.
Yes, uh-huh. He was such a dear person.
The FE company and the University of Alaska saw a lot of the early Alaskans help them through life.
Yes, oh yes.
They were all like Earl Beislein,
mm-hmm.
and my husband,
mm-hmm.
Don Cook, and the whole
mm-hmm.
group.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was at a very interesting thing one time when Harold Ickes came up here, the old curmudgeon. It made me think of it because Roy Erling introduced him and all. And they worked so hard. They had the wild game, and they had fish from Summit Lake and all the lovely things from the berries and everything. And he had just been newly married and really wasn't a bit interested in having any of his time taken. So Mr. Erling introduced him very nicely, as only Roy could do. And he got up to reply, and he said, "You know, this occasion reminds me of the old maid that asked the man to dinner." She said, "Well, come on over to dinner on Monday." And he said, "No, I'm busy, I can't come." "Well, come on Tuesday." "No, I can't come Tuesday either." "Well, come on Wednesday." "Oh, hell, I'll come Monday." And that was his entire reply to the niceness that the whole town had put on him. I, of course, was there because I was playing the background music. Oh, now, supposing I hadn't heard that, wouldn't that have been a terrible thing not to have heard? I think that was wonderful.
What an acceptance speech.
Yeah, what an acceptance speech. Yeah,
what
well,
a gracious answer.
Yes, I think that was lovely.
He wasn't noted for his...
No, he wasn't noted for how to win friends and influence people.
But he wrote me a nice letter, though, once. When we were back in Washington in 1937, Tony Diamond got us an appointment with Ickes, and Ickes was out of office, and his young assistant by the name of Berlew was there, and he gave us a very nice talk and said, had we known that trucks were going to be so... improved so fast, we wouldn't have had a railroad built up there. It would have been a truck road.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to protest the toll at the ferry at 90
Delta.
Miles out. It was $9.27 a ton for every ton you hauled from Valdez to Fairbanks.
Railroad operated the ferry.
The government
controlled the price.
That's right.
And they wanted to discourage too much Valdez freight so the railroad would get.
And Art stole that ferry. I didn't know whether he was going to be in the penitentiary or not. He stole the ferry, and Gene Rogie cut the telephone wires. He was the one that did it.
I helped myself.
I've heard that Gene Rogie held a gun on the marshal.
I don't think he did
that. Several guys
resented their... But Art actually stole the ferry.
I took it and took my truck across.
He decided that was just, cut the Gordian knot, just go ahead.
And left the ferry on the opposite side from the operator, or what is his name now? Cat Flanagan.
Flanagan, that's right.
And Flanagan, before I forget, his wife lived in a little cabin by the old Moose Hall, and his wife had some lady friends in there. And
this was long afterwards.
And Cap Flanagan came into the front room and says a few words, and he said, "Well, so long, sweetheart." Went in the bedroom, took a shotgun, and blew his brains out.
Mm.
That's the way he wound it up. But anyhow, after I left the truck on the wrong side of the ferry on the wrong side of the river, he called up town and told him what had happened. He
had to go quite a ways to call because Gene Rogie cut the telephone wire.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he crossed with a boat and Macintosh from the office.
Yes, it took him a long way.
Took him to Richardson.
So that they could get
10 miles with a car so he could telephone and say Loftus stole the ferry.
And I was raised in a totally law-abiding situation, you know.
Of course.
And the things that Art used to do, how I ever survived, I will never know. Because I was sure he'd wind up in the penitentiary. Then he ran afoul of, who was the fellow that had the woodyard, this Italian down here that was going to kill you?
Oh, Palestrina.
Palestrina.
I was tempted to kill him, too. He collected some money to plow out the highway when it was snowed in. He wanted to get out 40 miles for that Indian camp to trade for furs. Mm-hmm. And so he hired me and with a tractor to pull this big V-plow the road commission loaned him. They didn't need it anymore anyhow. And the Standard Oil had donated 6 barrels of gasoline. And before I went, Palestrini put some money in the bank in escrow to make me feel that I to ensure my getting something out of it. Mm-hmm. Well, when we got back, he wanted me to release that money. And we stood at the doorway and I said, now, do I get those 6 barrels of gas? Yes, you get the 6 barrels of gas. So I went in, released the money, and the next day when I went to Standard Oil to get the gas, it was gone. Palestrini had taken it. And he put it up out on, was it the Berry Ranch, just this out of town, this side of town, and he locked it up in one of the cabins there. Well, Harry Badger was in charge of that place, sort of an administrator, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I told Harry about it, and he said, well, he had no right to put a lock on that door. We'll break the lock, and you get your gas. So that's what we did. And then I forgot what further argument we had.
But Palestri was going to kill you, and here I was. I believed absolutely he would, and I had 3 tiny children. And I thought, my goodness, what have I gotten myself into here? But somehow or other, I don't know, all of these awful, dramatic situations ironed themselves out. And I was raised in a smooth situation like this. And so my married life has been totally different and extremely interesting. Not
what
one
about
day
the money him. That he had in escrow?
You never got that.
I had the bank release it to Palestrina.
You never got any of that.
No, I was happy to get those 6 barrels of gas for my trip out there. About a 2.5-3 day trip, I guess. I've forgotten. At least 2 day trip. And he just didn't want to give me anything.
No.
Just a plain crook.
Yeah. But many times, well, not many, but a lot of times, Art has worked 3 nights and 2 days, haven't you, without sleep?
Yeah, I was hauling,
against the breakups and things.
Yeah.
I was hauling dredge material out to the Fairbanks Creek. Art Anderson hauled it up to the top of the summit.
Of Andersonville down here, you know.
Yeah, and then he hired us to haul it the rest of the way down to Fairbanks Creek. And we worked, my Skinner and I, with the 2 tractors and sleds, worked 3 days and 2 nights straight through. And boy, was I sleepy the last day. I was eating breakfast there in the camp, and I was snoring and eating at the same time.
They were iron men. People had to be.
Yeah, had to be. Mm-hmm.
Then I hauled ore in Esther Dome, and my Skinner didn't show up. So I worked 6 days there, hauled 300 ton from near the Esther Road, a mile up the Long Ridge, then down into St. Patrick Creek to the mill there. Mm-hmm. And I just slept for that week. I just slept from 2 to 4 in the morning. And the rest of the time, busy as a dickens, and I didn't use any alarm clock either. I could wake up any time I wanted to. Kind of set my mind on it and get back to work.
Well, your children now, where do they live?
They all live in Oregon. Mm-hmm. The oldest one, who had the lessons from Mr. Gobra, and is a music major. He has his master's in music, and he's a very fine musician. Has been teaching in the schools there, but has decided to have his own studio. And he redoes organs and pianos and tunes. And his wife is a Japanese-American, a Phi Beta Kappa, and a Fulbright teacher. And she is in great demand substituting, and they have three delightful children, which are in the first house that Art built, and we are next door in the second house, which is pure joy. Then we have a daughter in Roseburg, and she has five children, three in college. And
six kids.
Five children, three in college, one in high school, and the baby.
Oh yeah, three boys and two girls.
That's right. And then we have another son out of Portland with three sons and a daughter. And then Ted, the youngest one, has a little boy, and he is in the Head Start program. He's counseling and teaching. Mm-hmm. So we have four children and 13 grandchildren. And life is very, very interesting and very full and very rewarding. And I think every Alaskan that comes within many miles of our area, we see. And that's what we like.
So we have lots to go back to.
Lots to go back to and lots to do, lots of interesting things.
Do you remember any who the mayor of Fairbanks was when the first mayor of Fairbanks? Or was the city organized? When
oh,
you came
yes.
Up here, when
yes. At one time. It seems to me that when my father was a district attorney, it was Clifford Smith's father, Murray Smith.
Yeah?
Yes, he was one of the mayors.
Yeah. Clifford Smith is the man who had the ice house.
Yes, Murray Smith.
His father.
And Clifford is back here for the first time for many,
right?
many years. He was there at the mug-up.
I know that. Many people pointed him out.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. His father had the ice house. Mm-hmm. And his father, I'm sure, was mayor in 1912. And, of course, nearly all of the attorneys were interesting, and nearly all of them, for instance, Tom Markham, very shrewd attorney from either Harvard or Yale, something from the East Coast, and he had, when Warren Harding came up here, Markham had very lately taken upon himself a wife from Fourth Avenue. She was an awfully nice person, but
Mignon,
she was, no, she wasn't Mignon. Mignon was the one that married Charlie Thompson that they afterwards decided had been thrown in a furnace when they went to Mexico, toward Mexico one time.
Yeah.
I don't think he married her. But anyway, Tom Markham married this woman, and lo and behold, the President of the United States was going to visit. It was Warren G. Harding. And all of the better people in Fairbanks were just...
must have been in a
It
net.
Was terrible. To think that she was going to be the first lady during this. So this Dr. Della Verne, who was very svelte and very sophisticated and what have you, did take over the master of ceremonies and all. And they did let Mrs. Markham ride in a car, and I can remember her yet. She had a hand-tatted dress over pink chiffon, and I'll never forget it. And after reading The President's Daughter and the shenanigans of the Harding life, they should have just let the whole thing go, and he would have had less stuffy time, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But wasn't that a strange anomaly?
One of the hottest days Fairbanks ever had.
And they all came with wool clothes.
Yeah, Harding rode up. Cushman Street, they're just red as a beet in the face and sweating like
And Herbert Hoover, my goodness, he almost melted away.
Yeah.
All with their wool suits and things, and had come up on the railroad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, they said their wives made them bring woolen underwear.
Yes,
whether or not
yeah.
they wore it then, uh-huh. I don't know, but I think they were told to wear it so they wouldn't freeze.
But isn't it fun to have been in on all of
yeah.
these things? We haven't missed a bit. Here when Wiley Post, you know, and bless his heart, Will Rogers, everything that ever came here, being such a small
community,
why, you always
did
knew.
You remember, were you at Weeksfield when Howard Hughes
yes.
landed here,
yes.
unloaded all the ping
yes.
pong balls?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
That's an interesting
mm-hmm.
story.
Very. And of course, we knew Ben Ileson very, very well.
Mm-hmm. And oh. Harold Gillum.
Art was great. Yeah, very yeah. fond of Harold Gillum.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember Howard Hughes and ping pong balls.
Well, yes.
He'd made a round the world
mm-hmm.
trip.
Yeah, and he'd just landed.
And Fairbanks, he landed here to fuel up.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to land in Calgary or Edmonton. I'm not sure if somewhere in that. Maybe Calgary wasn't even in existence at that time. I'm not sure. But he wasn't going to fly over any more water. when he left the East Coast, they put loaded ping pong balls for flotation in case he went down at sea.
Oh.
So when he landed here, Sam White told me the story first, mm-hmm. and I've heard the story from a couple of other people mm-hmm. too. As a matter of fact, Sam gave me 2 little ping pong balls.
Oh, good.
And I carefully preserved them because I want them to go to the archives. And why he did it, I don't know. Mm-hmm. He's just a generous, friendly
Sam's
man.
A darling. And Sam can write.
Yes. But apparently all the kids in town just ended up with scores of mm-hmm. ping pong balls, and there's mm-hmm. still some floating around. Mm-hmm. But that's just an... very interesting person in Fairbanks was Eva McGowan. Do you remember when Eva came?
I remember when she came. And when she came, she told me afterwards, after I was going, she came in, and she came from Ireland. Do you know how she happened to come?
She came to marry.
Yes, but the reason...
She sent for by...
The reason that she knew that this came about is because Mrs. Bob Bloom, had gone to school to Eva in Ireland. She came up here, and somehow or other, she had Eva corresponding with Arthur McGowan.
I see. She established the relationship.
And Eva wasn't in the first blush of youth, you know. Mm-hmm. When she came over the trail, and who should be on the in the double ender? But the former governor,
Troy.
No. The one from the land office.
Parks.
Parks, George Parks, and I think to the day she died, she had a very she really was still interested in Parks. And she came now. Arthur McGowan was a cook in the Arcade restaurant, and not a nice person for Eva. He wasn't very kind to her.
Kind of black visaged Irish.
Yes, he was. But she was gallant. She had her lovely things around her. And when she first came here, she put on a production for the 21st of June. I remember. And it was a children's operetta, and I had the lead. She picked me for the lead because I was singing in her choir as a little girl down in the Episcopal Church. And from then on, and then she was librarian, so I've known her since she came in 1914. Mm-hmm. And she was a gallant person. And the years that he was so very ill, he was a very difficult person, and she never wavered at all. Mm-hmm. She was a darling, just a darling.
I think she's the one that coaxed me to come and meet him when he was helpless and
That's
bad.
Right. We went. Oh, yes, and I did. Because she tried always for poor dear Arthur. She was, you know, she was just wonderful. And then during the war years, she's the one that saved the happiness and sanity of so many of these people that drifted in here.
World War II.
Yes, mm-hmm. that had no yeah. place to go.
She was an important link in
she
many
was.
Lives.
She was.
She had
an important transition thing for so many people who came. Like, for example, the first night I was in Fairbanks, I arrived and I tried to get a hotel room and I couldn't find a hotel room. Mm-hmm. It was October of 1949. And I slept on her couch in her office there in the Nordale lobby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Got propositioned by one of the guests at the hotel,
yes.
one of the old timers. I used to see him on the street.
You
He's
thought
dead
there was
now.
Room for two there?
He said he had plenty of room up in his room. That
oh.
He invited me up.
Well,
she's the one that got Bill and Dorothy Green to our house, you mm-hmm. know. All this lasting, deep friendship.
Mm-hmm. I sat in her office with 3-4 other people in there, and she's talking on the phone, and she's shooting the word to this and that. And had the quickest mind ever,
yeah.
ever noticed.
Yeah, she was a dear.
And generous, you know, to a fault.
Yeah.
The world has lost a lot, but I'm glad she's gone because she was getting so frail that her own physical body couldn't keep that gallant spirit anymore.
Right, and she stayed in her room there at the window.
Yes.
You know, she fell
yes.
one couple of times.
Uh-huh.
And she was confined to her room, not by the doctors, but more by Eva,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because of her pride and her, she just wasn't able to get around.
No. It was a privilege to know.
Oh, yeah. I really,
yeah.
They had a surprise birthday party for her on her 80th birthday, and I went to that. I worked at the newspaper then. I went and took some pictures. I just ran across the negatives and the contacts the other day, and I'm just so pleased I went to that.
Oh, yes.
There's one of Irene Sherman there with her arm around Eva, you know, and it's just something that I really prize.
When I remember when that fire burned Irene Sherman.
Tell me about that.
Well, Irene Sherman's mother was the daughter of the people that had the Third Avenue Hotel. Now, I was real young, and so a lot of this, I remember definitely the fire, but I remember hearing the background of it. Mm. And she really wasn't a very bright person. The younger sister wanted to be married, and they wouldn't let her be married till the older sister were. So this Irene's mother was married when she never should have married and produced progeny. So she was interested, and I believe it was a Negro man that she was interested in. And they went off and locked this house with her daughter and Dirty Face Porter. Now, it was Dirty Face Porter's home, I'm sure. And Dirty Face Porter had two children burned to death. And Irene was pulled out, tragically burned. And when she was a little girl, for years and years and years, she had a big hat, summer and winter, with this heavy, heavy black veil.
Burned them up on purpose?
No, just they locked the children in, and it got cold, and they tried to start a fire, and they lit a newspaper or something, and it caught the balloon ceiling, and it just went up and burned two children, and horribly burned this Irene. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've heard the story that Irene was trying to save. She went back in.
I don't think that's true. Really.
I have never really talked to Irene about it.
No, I don't think so, because she was just a tiny little girl. I don't think so. I think finally the people, it was close to the Eagle Hall, someplace along there, they came along and broke the window and hauled out the ones that, and one was too badly burned. And poor Irene. I don't think she ever went to school. She never, none of us ever saw her face for many, many, many years as I was growing up. That was one of the tragic fires, many, many, many tragic fires in Fairbanks growing up.
I took Irene to lunch last Friday.
You're a good girl.
And you know where I took her? To the Petroleum Club.
You are a good girl.
But my husband belongs, and for business reasons, and we seldom go up there, and he has to pay a certain fee every quarter, and if he doesn't use it up in services or meals or lunch or something there at the club,
You have to pay anyway.
You just have to pay it anyway. So he's always encouraging me if you want to go to lunch, go to lunch. So Kay Kennedy and I, in June when she was here, we're talking about. We ended up over at the International Bar having a beer about 11 o'clock at night with Irene. We just were driving through town and we were coming home from Pioneers meeting. And so I said, you know what? She was supposed to be back here at Golden Days time. I said, let's take her to lunch. And we can all be, I said, I want to take her to Petroleum Club. I bet she's never been up there. And so Kay was supposed to come back, but she didn't make it. So I went ahead and set it up. And we were talking after we left. We left Irene. When we left her, she had three full beers in front of her. She drinks nothing but Ola, you know. And we had one drink and then came on home because it was kind of late. And I said, you know what I'm going to do, Kay? I'm going to ask Harold Billum if he'll go with us. He's the mayor now.
Oh.
So I did, and by George, he did. So I went up there last Friday, and I took Irene up. I went over to get her, picked her up. I took her, before we went up, encouraged her to leave her paper sack in the car because I locked the car. Yeah. But she had her belt on, and she has a big Ole mug. It's a mug, you know, plastic mug. It says Olympic beer on it. But she was all dolled up in her new Golden Days outfit, big beautiful hat, this old mangy fur cape, and I don't know where she got it. So she wasn't, I figured we could get away with it and we wouldn't get thrown out in Golden Days time. So we went up there and the hostess knows her. And she went up to her and threw her arms around her and said, Irene, how nice to see you. Aww. It's been so long. And they were, you know, they knew each other. The woman had worked in a restaurant or bar or something, so they met somewhere. Must have been a bar. So I took the lady aside and I said, now the mayor's going to come up and join us for lunch, but I don't want Irene to know it. And but before we went up, I said, now Irene, this is a private club, and we really have to watch our language up here. They might throw us out of the 10th floor. It's a long way down. She said, okay, okay, honey. And we went up, and she was just a perfect lady. And she was just like a child. She had, she says, by George, that's Cap Lathrop's lash up right down there, isn't it, honey? She looked, for the first time, she looked down on Lathrop bed, and she saw the, and a little later, she didn't know that Harold Gillum was going to join us for lunch. And wouldn't you know it, there was a table of about six women, two of the biggest snobs in town, which I can kind of consider snobs. They think the Petroleum Club, they talk about it. Well, we went to the club, you know, we'll meet you at the club, this kind of stuff. So here I came waltzing in with old Irene, and this one, oh, if looks could have killed, she just, you know, just turned around like that. So we sat there, and Irene was just enjoying herself immensely, looking down on everything. And then pretty soon the mayor walked in. He stopped by this table of six ladies. How do you do? How do you do? How do you do? He came over and sat with us.
He's a nice looking guy.
Isn't
he? I thought that was so nice of Harold to do. And it was something I just wanted to do for Irene.
Now tell me, I have never actually talked to her because she didn't come back here until after we left.
She said she was out in Seattle from 8 to 18. Then she came back after she
was here. But she wasn't right here in Fairbanks. She was out in the hinterlands, I'm sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. She was down at Healy.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Her face is scorched somewhat.
Oh, yes. Terribly scorched.
How
her
is
hands.
She mentally? Is she fairly...
She has a belligerent attitude. Not a belligerent attitude. She has a real hard attitude about life. But she's accepted her position as it is, and that's it.
And why wouldn't she have a feeling like that, too?
I'm going to interview her one of these days. I'm going to go over there and take a six-pack of Oli. And her house is just, you wouldn't believe what she lives in. It's just...